This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. From the morning shower to brushing and flossing, doing the laundry, loading the dishwasher, our daily routines are marked by efforts to avoid germs. While it's fairly obvious why we do it, the cumulative effect of germ avoidance is less apparent. A group of evolutionary biologists propose that such avoidance is extremely significant. In fact, they theorize that cultures across the world have been largely shaped by the struggle to avoid disease. Here with more is Ethan Waters. He wrote about some of those biologists in an article called The Germ Theory of Democracy, Dictatorship, and All Your Most Cherished Beliefs, which was published in Pacific Standard. Ethan Waters, great to have you on Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
In the article, you profile the evolutionary biologist Randy Thornhill primarily and his pathogen stress theory. This is a potentially paradigm-shifting theory of human behavior. Can you summarize it for us?
He's really swinging for the fences with this one, for sure. This is the idea that we have psychological mechanisms that bring us to avoid diseases. You know, and as you said, you could see that on a sort of daily basis. But his theory is that these mechanisms over time in culture have an enormous effect on things that we wouldn't necessarily think they would have an effect on, like what sort of government you have, whether you have a group that is interdependent or a group that values independence. And the idea is that certain places in the world, you have higher disease loads. And because of that, you tend to go towards behavior that would, say, favor your in-group or keep outsiders at bay because you would have developed immune resistance to the diseases around you, but maybe not to the ones that over the hill. So you tend to have these sort of social structures that get going under the pressure of disease. And alternatively, in other places where there's a lower disease threat, you have a different set of evolutionary pressures that allow for perhaps more independent thinking, more trade with other people because you don't have those disease loads, which leads to another set of cultural sort of behaviors that have an effect generation after generation that lead to other outcomes, like in Thornhill's theories, democracies in one place, autocratic governments in another place, higher religious displays in certain places, more cultural diversity in some places and less so in other places.
Okay, so that's a big load of things out there. Part of the breakdown that Thornhill does is looks at things regionally, and it seems to me sort of determined by climate. This is something that's been done before. You know, there seems to be more democratically run societies in the Northern Hemisphere and fewer in the Global South. What does climate have to do with this?
Right. So climate, in places where it's warm and wet, you know, traditionally, certainly over time, you've had higher disease loads. So you have the malaria, you have the dengue fever, you have really pernicious and ongoing disease threats. And this is because that certain bugs, you know, need certain climate elements to sort of survive. So in certain places of the world, there's no doubt that traditionally there has been higher disease loads. And the theory is that when that happens, you tend to do a number of things within your culture. You tend to keep outsiders more away. You tend to invest in your in-group more. And that would lead potentially to more sort of patriarchal societies, more traditional societies, societies where custom is really held tightly to. And the idea is that when you move away from those zones, the opposite thing happens.
Mm-hmm. So you become more xenophobic in places where there is, what, a heavier pathogen load? Is that the way he puts it?
Exactly. Where disease is always around you, you tend to invest in your in-group. You tend to marry in. You tend to keep outsiders at bay. And when you do that generation after generation, you tend to create social structures, religions that reinforce this, governments that reinforce this, and social values and behaviors and things that we think are sort of most central to our beliefs about the world. Thornhill believes comes from these disease avoidance behaviors over time.
Well, you know, Ethan, I was just sort of observing myself on a plane about a week ago when someone was sneezing next to me, and this sort of like moment of revulsion and disgust and fear, you know, reeling back, thinking that you might get sick. I understand that on a kind of visceral level. discarding our waste, you know, away from our homes, avoiding sick people, not handling the dead. These are examples that we have actually in the natural world. Where do we find those?
Absolutely. I mean, human cultures have, you know, we have all sorts of ways of avoiding disease, and we tend to think of it as just sort of a natural reaction, and we tend to think of it as not affecting our values about the world. But there's another set of researchers up in British Columbia who've actually done sort of experiments basically very similar to the one you just had on the plane, where they'll cue people to a disease threat, and then they will ask them questions about whether the government should give money to help immigrants from a foreign country. And after they've been cued with that disease threat, their values tend to shift significantly on that exact topic. People that have been cued to the threat of disease will be more likely to say, well, actually, we shouldn't give money to help those people come from that foreign country. Whereas the people that weren't given the disease condition were more likely to express more liberal values. The reason that the liberal values come about when there's less disease in Thornhill's theory is that the ways we defend against diseases are actually evolutionary kind of costly. To keep outsiders at bay means you're not trading with other people. It means you're not spreading your genetic material in other areas because you're not mating with other people. When that disease threat goes away, the theory goes, you tend to go away from those costly behaviors. You tend to trade more. You tend to marry out groups more. The trade leads to increased wealth. Wealth can lead to increased education. Education can lead to things like, you know, democracies and land ownership and so forth like that. So you have this sort of cycle that goes on in the lower disease regions where you give up these sort of costly ways of keeping diseases at bay.
We're talking about pathogen stress theory, a potentially paradigm-shifting theory that can help explain human behavior and culture and how it developed in certain societies. The idea has been put forward and tested by an evolutionary biologist named Randy Thornhill and one named Corey Fincher. We're speaking with Ethan Waters, who wrote about their work for Pacific Standard magazine. How does it extend to this idea of, whether or not you're a democratic or a dictatorship type of political structure? What does it mean in terms of religion and belief and personal beliefs?
Well, many of these things like religion can in part be seen as displays of group membership. So the idea behind religion is that if you live in a place where you really need to know who's in my group and who's in that other group, and you need to know that because that other group might have a disease that you haven't developed a resistance to. So there are places in the world where there's really a patchwork of diseases. Even a similar disease will have different enough genetic material from one town to the next that will make that a threat to you, even if you have a resistance to your local disease. So if you live in a place like that, you need a way to display when someone walks down the road towards you, whether that person is in your group or not in your group. And religion, in one level, can be seen as a display of group membership. And so if you need a very, very micro way of understanding who's in your group and who's not, you tend to develop religious displays that are very dramatic, that make it very clear who's in your group and who's not, as with things like dress and cultural customs, dialects, and so on. You develop this patchwork of cultures so that you can tell I'm different from the person just down the road, because you need to know that because of this disease avoidance behavior. That's how the theory goes.
How did they test their hypothesis?
Well, basically, they're dealing with large data sets at this point. So one of the things that they're not doing is basically going and observing this on a very local level. There is data on whether societies are collectivists or individualists. There's data on whether societies are democratic or not. There's data about those religious subgroups and so forth. And they'll take that data set, and then they'll take data sets about disease prevalence and put them together and see if they can make a correlation between higher disease prevalence, say, and patriarchal systems, or higher disease prevalence and high religiosity and so forth. And they're finding this very a significant correlation. Of course, one of the criticisms of the disease of the theory is that correlations that don't actually make causation, and they have gotten some criticism from jumping too quickly from, oh, we have a correlation here, then we must have the cause. There's a remarkable amount of evidence out there on this. It is not just, you know, some graduate student's theory. There's significant research out there, but this is still early days for this theory, and a whole lot more needs to be done in terms of understanding this connection between disease and culture.
Yeah, it does seem like painting with a pretty broad brush. This also, in some ways, could tip into a tricky territory of justifying xenophobia and ethnocentric behavior. How does Fincher and his colleagues address these kind of concerns?
Well, they've dealt, you know, being evolutionary psychologists, they've dealt with this thing before, and it's really a tricky thing for these people because they're looking for the fundamental motivations of human behavior, and that goes to sexual behavior, our values, our governments, and so forth, and they're looking for the evolutionary cues and the psychological mechanisms that might make our behavior understandable. In doing so, people often misread it as saying, oh, then that behavior is justifiable. If it's evolutionary, it must be okay, or we have to behave this way. And I don't think any Thornhill and Fincher and none of the evolutionary theorists I've talked to are actually make that case, but people hear it that way, which is very unfortunate because I think to understand these behaviors, to understand xenophobia and racism and so forth, we do need to know the psychological mechanisms that underlie them. And even if there are those mechanisms, that doesn't mean that we're locked into behaving that way, and it certainly doesn't justify any behavior. But I think the idea is if we understand this behavior better, we can mitigate it more. And if we understand, for instance, that, you know, health is behind a lowering of racism or lowering of xenophobia, I think we have some really interesting new ways of thinking about if you want to live in a world without xenophobia and racism, what we need to do next.
Ethan Waters, I want to thank you for helping us understand this better today. Thank you.
Oh, a pleasure.
Ethan Waters, a frequent contributor to the New York Times Magazine, Discover, Men's Journal, Details, Wired, and PRI's This American Life. He wrote an article called The Germ Theory of Democracy, Dictatorship, and All of Your Most Cherished Beliefs for Pacific Standard. You'll find a link to read that article at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. So from culture seeding germs, we're going to go next to a virus straight out of science fiction. When Word of Mouth continues, we'll discuss the recently discovered pithovirus, which has been sealed in the Siberian permafrost for more than 30,000 years. And what happens if all that ice melts? This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. The 1971 science fiction film The Andromeda Strain exploited human fears about space exploration. In the film, an extraterrestrial virus introduced to Earth mutates and rapidly kills with little distinction.
It's crazy. I didn't know buzzards fly at night.
Buzzards only come when something's dead.
Lando Dagger to Cable One. What's happening?
We see bodies. Lots of them.
These people were cut down in mid-stride.
The terrifying Andromeda Strain had otherworldly origins, but in recent years, new potentially harmful giant viruses have been discovered all over planet Earth. The recently discovered pithovirus has been sealed in the Siberian permafrost for more than 30,000 years. While this and many other giant viruses are considered harmless to humans, others unearthed by rapidly thawing ice may not be so benign. Here with more is John Timmer, senior science editor at Ars Technica, who wrote about the discovery of the giant pithovirus. John, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Giant virus does sound so ominous. Is a giant virus very distinct from regular run-of-the-mill virus?
Yeah, in several ways. So to begin with, the giant name comes from the fact that these are actually big enough to be seen with a standard microscope. Normally, to visualize a virus, you need a very fancy high-end electron microscope, but these can be seen with a standard optical one.
Where are some examples of where giant viruses have been found in recent years, and why all the interest in recent years?
Those are two interesting questions. So one of the best examples of the discovery of a giant virus was somebody came into a clinic with an eye infection, and it turned out they were reusing their sterile contact lens cleaning fluid.
Ew.
And when the lab grew out what was infecting her eye, it was an amoeba. And when they checked the amoeba, it had a virus in it. And when they checked the virus, it had a virus growing in it. So it was an entire little ecosystem growing in this woman's eye because she wasn't being careful with her contact lens cleaner.
Okay, we're all – everyone in the studio is waving their arms and getting icked out by that.
Yes.
Any other places in nature where they may have been discovered, giant viruses?
They found them in the ocean, pretty much anywhere the amoebas can grow, which is in the soil and water. You can find viruses infecting them.
Okay, that second part of the question I asked you, why all of these recent discoveries of giant viruses?
To begin with, nobody really knew what they were looking at. There's a chance somebody actually saw one of these viruses in the microscope back in the 50s and just had no clue it was a virus, assumed something that big was almost certainly a bacteria. So we could have been missing them for decades. This one lab has now specialized in identifying them. It's a group in France that studies these. Because so far the only ones we know about affect amoebas, they basically culture amoebas in different conditions and try to find viruses growing out of them. And they're interesting because they contain a bizarre mixture of genes. One of the viruses actually has over 2,000 genes that we've never seen before. And usually when we study things like bacteria or animals, we find that the genes kind of look familiar because all bacteria are related to each other, all animals are related to each other. And in these viruses, there's thousands of genes we've never seen before. So it's really interesting to try to figure out what these genes do and how they came about through evolution.
Well, let's get to this recent discovery of the pithovirus. Where was it found?
So the group in this case collaborated with some Russian researchers who used sterile techniques to obtain a sample of permafrost that's been, we know, has been frozen for about 32,000 years. And all they did was grow the amoebas that they know these viruses tend to victimize in with a chunk of the permafrost. And then they checked to see whether the amoebas were growing in a healthy manner. And in fact, these viruses, after they had infect the cells, explode them in order to spread further. And all they had to do was look for exploding cells, and they had a sign that a virus was in action.
So as you explained it, the researchers added a little bit of permafrost to this culture of amoebas. The amoebas just exploded because of this pithovirus. I don't know about you, but that doesn't sound very good. I mean, should we be worried about the effects of such an active virus on humans?
No, because amoebas are very evolutionarily distant from us. It's been billions of years since we shared a common ancestor with them. So the viruses that attack them are overwhelmingly unlikely to attack human cells.
You describe the pithovirus as sort of distinct and remarkable compared to other giant viruses. What are some of those distinctions?
There's at least three different families of giant viruses, and this is the pithovirus is the first member of the third family we've discovered. And it shares some features with the other giant viruses in terms of how it attacks cells and the physical shape of the virus, but its genome is much smaller. It's got fewer genes, it's got less DNA than the other viruses, which is quite unusual.
Well, what does that mean?
It's hard to say what that means. It basically means that there are more lifestyles compatible with being a giant virus than we knew about previously.
So the Arctic ice is melting in so many places, which means that more and more permafrost is being uncovered. And the implications being twofold, more humans moving in, and there's a potential for more ancient giant viruses to be uncovered. Is this a concern?
So it's not the giant viruses we're worried about so much because, like I said, so far the only ones we know about attack amoebas. But, you know, there could be other viruses there. And in fact, you know, a few years ago, people recovered the 1918 flu virus from bodies that were buried in permafrost during the epidemic. And the potential is that there are other viruses that have been, you know, up there for unknown number of years that might start thawing out.
Well, John Timmer, you've introduced us to a whole host of sleeping giants. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
John Timmer, senior science editor at Ars Technica. He wrote about the discovery of the pithovirus, and we have a link to read his article and much more on the giant viruses being discovered at wordofmouthradio.org. Probiotic is now a selling point for food. Probiotic supplements and foods like yogurt, kimchi, and kombucha all promise to aid in digestion and general health by breeding good gut bacteria. A Cambridge, Massachusetts startup is among a flood of enterprises looking at the effects of bacteria outside the body. AO Biome is testing a body spray, which it says can restore healthy, deodorizing, immune-boosting, anti-inflammatory bacteria to the skin and hair. Exactly the microscopic stuff we regularly wash away with soap and shampoo. Journalist and radio producer Julia Scott played guinea pig, going for a month without bathing, to test AO Biome's refreshing cosmetic mist. She wrote about the experience for the New York Times Magazine. Julia Scott, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
So tell us more about this refreshing cosmetic mist product. What is it, and what does AO Biome theorize that it can do?
So the product is called AO Plus, which stands for ammonia oxidizing. The ammonia oxidizing bacteria in this spray is called Nitrosomonas eutropha, which is kind of a mouthful. And it's bacteria, live bacteria, that the company is hoping to sell people like me and you to spray on our skin every day after we bathe. And it is their contention that this spray will make your skin feel more hydrated and healthier, and possibly in the long run cause you to have less of a need for cleaning products and maybe even deodorant as well.
So you said after we bathe, that means that you went to the extremes. AO Plus would be used sort of like we use deodorant now.
Conceivably. It depends on people's own body odor needs, I guess. But yes, I did go to the extreme for my story. What I decided to do to test out their product was to give myself the challenge of becoming a study subject for them for 28 days, try out their product, but remove all the conceivable variables, because the company had warned me that their body spray contained bacteria that, in spite of, you know, being 20 million bacteria for each spritz, are very sensitive to modern cleaning products and shampoos. I decided, well, I wasn't going to take any chances and spent the entire 28-day study period without washing myself with soaps, shampoos. I also gave up deodorants, moisturizers, face cleansers, everything in my cabinet, basically.
So you misted yourself twice a day and you were swabbed each week to detect changes. Did anyone notice or comment on your unwashed self or appearance?
You know, I will tell you that if you want to know who your real friends are, be sure to ask them to smell you after 28 days of not bathing with soap or shampoo and tell you what they think. So I have some very good friends. Some of them were even brave enough to get their nose right in there under my arms and give me lengthy descriptions of what I smelled like. Others said I smelled great, but they were usually on the other side of the room when they said it.
Here are some reactions that you managed to get on tape.
Julia smelled like scalp. Her hair looked like she had lathered it with butter.
I never saw any proof that she's actually writing this article, so I wonder if she just got really lazy for a month.
I'm really curious about the friend who pushed the nose right into the armpit. What was the reaction there?
You know, I got everything from, "You smell like my Dutch grandmother," to, "You smell like a homeless person," which is not what you want to hear, to, "You smell like onions," which I myself had detected, to, "You smell like pleasant pot," which was interesting.
It doesn't sound like it works then.
Well, here's the thing. You know, first of all, it's I can't say whether it works or doesn't. I do know that the function of these bacteria are to oxidize ammonia in your sweat and turn them into scent-free harmless byproducts, nitrite and nitric oxide. So they kind of kidnap the smelling process, but they need sweat in order to do it. And the only time I really sweated was when I went to the gym. And let me tell you, I avoided going to the gym for much of the experiment for just that reason. I was afraid it was going to happen. But it was the one time in the experiment that after I sprayed myself with the bacteria before and after, my smell was gone.
This kind of reminds me of, do you remember like 10 years ago, there was this unshampoo movement? You know, people said you shouldn't shampoo your hair. You should just condition it or whatever. And there was this argument that we've trained our bodies to need washing. I wonder what you observed. Was your hair less greasy? Was your skin greasy? Did you have breakouts? Just curious.
You know, what's interesting, first of all, is that the no poo movement, no shampoo, actually still exists. I discovered it online in the course of my research, and it seems to have more adherence than ever. People who say that shampoo is, you know, is hurting us, and so are modern cleansers, and so they go without in many cases. You know, I observed that my skin actually, although my hair became very greasy and disgusting, my skin ended up feeling surprisingly hydrated. It was sort of like I had started visiting the sauna every week. And I also observed that my hormonally related breakouts disappeared, which was very unexpected because I had spent my teenage years taking antibiotics to clear up my skin to no avail. And all of a sudden, here I was spraying probiotics, which might have had a more positive result all along.
Julia Scott is with us. She's a writer and radio producer who tried out a new live bacteria body spray, which is basically a probiotic for your skin, and wrote about the experience for the New York Times Magazine. Do you think something like the AO Biome spray could catch on?
I have a sense that it will, and I'll tell you why. The question, are we too clean, speaks to the fact that, you know, I think we're starting to recast our relationship with bacteria. And in fact, most bacteria has evolved to help us in ways that we don't yet understand. Now, that said, you'd think that a live probiotic body spray that looks and smells and tastes like water would not be an easy sell. But in fact, to my understanding, AO Biome has received more than 7,000 orders since my article came out.
Well, your article really did stir up quite a storm, but I've noticed that it's being cast as kind of a should we wash or not wash? I mean, that seems to be where the argument is coming down. And I'm wondering how public health officials, you know, people who want signs everywhere that say wash your hands after using the bathroom, how have they reacted to your article?
I haven't really seen too much of a reaction from public health officials, but I'll take this opportunity to say that hygiene is essential, and I did wash my hands during the experiment. There was no question that I wasn't going to, you know, stay healthy. And, you know, I don't think probiotics have come to the point yet where, you know, we're going to be spraying our hands with bacteria before we go into the surgical chamber in hospitals instead of using antibacterials. But I do think that the reason that we're talking about, you know, smell and cleanliness is that the entire role of soap has changed. It used to be for medical purposes, and now we've been persuaded that we need all kinds of products, not just to, you know, wipe away basic grime from our hands, but to be good smelling, to mask our personal odors at the same time as they wash our oils away. You know, my grandmother, you know, when she was growing up, never showered every day the way I grew up showering every day. She showered once a week and she washed her hair once a week. And, you know, she's just no smellier than I am.
The chemist who created AO Plus Cosmetic Mist had not showered for 12 years. I'm wondering if you are considering making the leap into the non-shampooing, non-soaping, just misting.
No. Short answer is no. You know, if there's one thing this experiment taught me is that I desperately need shampoo in my hair. However, I will say that I did change my habits radically after I stopped using AO Plus. I now only use shampoo twice a week instead of every day. I've stopped using deodorant with odor in it. I use fragrance-free deodorant. And I don't use any cleansers on my face at all. You know, I used to have like three or four different washes for my face and my body. So I ended up throwing out, you know, 75% of the cleaning products I was using. And I did it because I wanted to challenge myself to try to create as hospitable a personal biome as I could for my microflora, because I sort of got to know my own universe of bacteria up close during this experiment. And in the end, I think the biggest transformation was psychological, because I couldn't bear the thought of harming them more than I needed to.
Julia Scott, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My huge pleasure.
Julia Scott is a writer and a radio producer. You can find a link to her article for the New York Times Magazine and read more about AO Biome at wordofmouthradio.org. Whether they are good essential bacteria or the bad kinds of germs that make us sick, the tricky thing about microorganisms of all kind is exactly that. They are micro. We can't see them, and if you think there are people with bad hygiene out there today, imagine what life was like before germ theory even existed. Our next story comes from Stephen Dubner of Freakonomics Radio.
In the mid-19th century, Vienna General Hospital was considered a world-class research center. But the hospital's maternity ward didn't have such a good reputation.
Because it became known throughout the city of Vienna that if you went on to the doctor's division or the doctor's clinic, you were much more likely to die.
That's Sherwin Newland. He's a professor of medicine at Yale. He wrote a book called The Doctor's Plague about the situation at Vienna General Hospital. In the early 1840s, 1 in 10 women whose baby was delivered by a doctor there died from what was called childbed fever.
Childbed fever is an infection primarily of the uterus, and it spreads out through the tubes into the abdominal cavity of women immediately after they have given birth.
In 1847, 1 in 6 women died, and that was the year a young Hungarian-born doctor named Ignaz Semmelweis joined the staff. He was horrified by the situation, and he went digging in the numbers for a clue. Now, here was something strange. There were two separate maternity wards in the hospital, one staffed by doctors, who were all male, and the other by midwives, who were female. The death rate in the midwives' ward was far lower. So was it a guy thing that was causing all this death? One theory at the time held that birthing mothers were such fragile creatures that being seen naked by a male doctor was enough to kill them. Now, Semmelweis didn't buy it. He also discovered that women who delivered their own babies on the street had an even lower rate of childbed fever.
In those days, it would occasionally happen that a woman out of wedlock would deliver herself. Sometimes in the streets, the Germans had a word for it, Gassengeburt. They were street births, and he was hard put to find anybody who died when a woman self-delivered.
And so Semmelweis came to suspect the likely cause of these thousands of deaths, his fellow doctors. But how? The answer came in the form of a tragedy. A colleague of Semmelweis's, a doctor he admired, died after getting gangrene. He had pricked his finger with a knife while giving a lesson in autopsy.
And Semmelweis was away on a brief vacation when this happened. But when he came back, he began to study scrupulously the autopsy findings of his friend and noted that they were just like the autopsy findings of women with childbed fever who were dying.
His conclusion? Doctors were carrying what he called invisible cadaver particles into the maternity ward, better known today as bacteria. But remember, This is the mid-1800s, pre-germ theory.
Consider a typical morning of a student or a young doctor in training. The very first thing he would do in the morning was to go to the dead house, as it was often called, and to do an autopsy on one of the women who had died the day before. And when the abdomen is open, there is a sea of pus around the uterus, around the tubes. The young doctor will put his hands in this. He then probably wipes his hands on a towel and goes up to take on his regular duties as an obstetrician in training. Sometimes he'll have one hand will be on the patient's abdomen, another will be in the vagina, and he'll be feeling that uterus with the two hands. And you can see all of the opportunity for infecting the inside of a woman's body with the cadaver particles, invisible cadaver particles made obvious only by their smell.
Semmelweis figured if he could get rid of the smell, he could get rid of the dangerous particles. So he ordered every medical attendant who entered the doctor's ward to submerge his hands in a chlorine wash before seeing patients. Within 6 months, the death rate of women in the doctor's ward had plummeted.
And that was it. It was as simple as that.
Yale professor Sherwin Newland there, along with Stephen J. Dubner, host of Freakonomics Radio. Despite the progress made at Vienna General Hospital in the mid-19th century, hand hygiene among doctors today is not nearly as good as you might think. You can get the rest of the story by listening to the full episode. There's a link to hear it at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, we've been hearing today about the things that we cannot see that affect our health. Up next, we're going to talk to a filmmaker who keeps his camera on, unflinchingly so, and trained on himself as multiple sclerosis takes over his body. A moving story of lost mobility, but also of creativity and courage. That's coming up when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Jason DeSilva was one of those filmmakers other young directors wanted to be. Talented, handsome, imaginative, and at 25, well-regarded enough to fund travel around the world to make documentary films. That was then.
You can take that scooter.
I just started using a cane, and they're already talking about wheelchairs.
That's Jason DeSilva a little more than a year after being diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. No amount of will, exercise, nor attempted cures could stave off the decline of his body. His sharp creative mind, however, kept working and filming. The result is When I Walk, making its national broadcast premiere on PBS and kicking off this year's POV series of documentary films on Monday. And Jason DeSilva is with us to talk about the film. Jason, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Now, you've been diagnosed with MS, but hadn't really seen it manifest until vacation in St. Martin, and this is 2006. We see it on film. Your legs just give way on the beach, and you struggle to get up. Did you ever question that you turned this whole experience into a film?
Not at the time. You know, so, like, at first, it was really just to document. I was out there on that beach, actually, so that whole scene, I was just documenting the planes flying overhead. You know, it's interesting that there's a beach and all of a sudden there's an airport that's really close to it. But then all of a sudden my brother took the camera and turned it on me just to film myself not being able to get up again. And from there, what became was When I Walk.
Jason, you're so unsparing the way that you keep the camera trained on yourself as you lose mobility, you lose motor skills. You know, we see you waking up in the morning and struggling to get up and put your clothing on, several falls, things that you could edit out, obviously, to make this a different kind of film. So is that your instinct? I mean, do you think this is how I would treat other documentary subjects? Why not me? I'm interested in those decisions.
I had a lot of people to help me just kind of review the footage and look over what I did. I thought that beach scene was kind of cool. So that's why I made it to the early edits. But a lot of the other stuff where I was, you know, I just was falling with my walker and just scenes like that in general where I couldn't get up out of bed myself. Those I wanted to keep out. But a lot of people that I was working with, they were like, why don't you keep that scene in there? You know, it's like something profound. It took about 2 years of filming till I understood that things like that were really important to keep in for a film like this, and just to be honest to the viewer, and just to myself as well.
Well, you were funded to make a film in India, which you found that it was just too difficult to do, and you turned this trip into an exploration of cures. What are some of the various cures that you tried?
Yeah, that's a good question. So on that trip, the things that I was looking into were really alternative treatments. So as you said, there's no cure for my kind of MS. So it really is, we're left to the wide world of alternative treatments. So in India, I was looking into transformational psychology and meditation as well. So that was one thing I did. I looked into yoga, and I still look into yoga. And I don't think that these things are not beneficial. I think they're really important. And the third thing I was looking into was Ayurvedic medicine as well. So, I just have people put a lot of different oils on me and ended up getting really messy. But it worked out well.
Well, nothing cured you, so to speak, and you later did try this vascular treatment that you found out about on the internet. Was there a moment for you, Jason, when you just accepted, okay, this is happening, this is where I am, this is how it's going to be?
You know, that's a good question. So even to this day, I'm still surprised by it. Every morning when I wake up and when I can't get out of bed without somebody else's help, things like that, I'm still surprised by it. Or even like going day to day and having to drive around in my power chair, it surprises me. But there's a certain level of acceptance that came. It was probably, it wasn't until I put the film out there and it premiered at Sundance that I felt like, you know, it's okay. Like what I'm going through is really hard, but at least it's going to help other people as well.
Well, you mentioned that you got help from other people. Alice, who you were dating, became your wife. But some of that fighting spirit must come from your mother, Marianne D'Souza. Now, here she is in the film giving you a pretty good talking to when you say that you don't think that you can finish your film.
Well, you constantly talk about being sick all the time anyway. You know, it's constant. You're always whining and sighing. You only have one life, and I know I miss practicality, but we don't know how long we have to live. We could be dead tomorrow. Quit your film right now. How does it feel? Just quit. Yeah, seriously. Do you feel like a sense of relief?
I'm just saying that it's really tough to make the film. I'm not going to quit the film, but it's really tough making the film.
Things are tough in life. Get real.
It's true.
You mollycoddle North American kid.
That's a clip from the film When I Walk. I'm speaking with one of the film's directors and producers, Jason DeSilva, also the subject of the film. That was your mother there, Jason, you know, being pretty strident and whatever the opposite of whiny is. But you're kind of smirking. How did that sit with you? Her saying like, oh, you think you have it bad? People have it worse.
Yeah, well, for me, that scene was, I was really happy to catch that on camera. Because she's like that every day, even though it doesn't. But my smirk is, it's just me being pleased with the fact that it got that on camera for the rest of the world to see. This is what I have to deal with every day for the for all my life, until I'm old. I have to deal with my mom saying things like that.
Well, you take her advice and you attend an MS support group, which is pretty fortunate because you meet Alice Cook, who you begin seeing. We see that in the film. You go to Hawaii together. There's this wonderful scene of you riding scooters down the ramp at the Guggenheim.
But as you guys get more serious, you ask her some very frank questions about your future. You know, what happens when I can't eat my food? Will you be the person who feeds me? Do you think you're able to ask those questions or maybe emboldened because you are making a film?
Yeah, I do, actually. I would definitely be more graceful and just kind of easier about it than I was when I was confronting her with the camera. You know, like, I wouldn't have been like, so are you going to be the person that feeds me if I didn't have a camera right in front of her and asking her those questions?
Well, you want to get married, you two want to have a family, which you can do physically, but we overhear these crucial conversations about your intimacy, and here's a clip from the film about longevity.
How do you think about your, like, 40s and your 50s? Are you scared ever?
Scared of my 40s and 50s? No, it just... I'm not gonna live past 50, which sucks, but I'm gonna, like, do everything I can before that. I think I'm just, like, kind of pissed off that, like, that this happened. And that the world's not really, like, accommodating.
That's a clip from the film When I Walk. I'm speaking to the film's director, producer, and subject, Jason De Silva. And Jason, as your bodily functions wane, you become more and more dependent on Alice, who is just indefatigable, except in some moments when she is talking to the camera herself, you know, admitting fear, admitting that she feels trapped at times, and showing a great deal of vulnerability. Had you seen those before you were editing the film? I mean, were you present for those moments?
No, actually. No, I wasn't. So a lot of the stuff she gave to me afterwards just as footage, you know, so I didn't actually... I mean, I did see the fact... I did know the fact that she and that's why we got married, and I wanted her in my life. I didn't know that she had those aspects in her and could talk about those things, but I didn't know that she could on the camera, and so that was a big thing. So looking at the footage afterwards and her revealing what she was thinking, those were things that even surprised me.
There's so much joy in this film, and I don't want to diminish that at all. A lot of creativity, a lot of courage and doing good. In fact, you and Alice helped create this app for helping people find handicapped accessible places in New York City. And you mentioned this kind of sense of acceptance when you watched the film at Sundance. Watching it now, where do you think you'll go? What is your trajectory?
Oh, well, I know. I'm pretty clear about, like, what I'm doing next and, yeah, where to go from here. I mean, obviously, it took... After you work on a film like When I Walk, which is a 5-7 film that's a personal film, I think I went under a tight existential crisis as a creative person, where I had to question about what is the next thing that I want to do with myself? Is it really worth it to keep going as a filmmaker? And then I turned around and decided, so after about a year, that there really is just a lot more of this story that needs to be told, especially about, like, what the next level of disability is like for me, and even what issues like accessibility and even fatherhood now, like, what do those things, like, what are those things like? I think that those are new things just for me to explore, but for people to hear about as well.
Well, Jason De Silva, best of luck to you, and thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Jason De Silva, director and producer of the film When I Walk, which is making its national broadcast premiere on POV. That's on Monday, June 23rd. You can check the local listings and see a clip from the film at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for joining us. And we invite you back for more Word of Mouth, Monday at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.